This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Before we begin today, I want to pause to remember Howard Zinn, who died on January 27th. Howard Zinn was our teacher. He taught that the history of the United States is the history of class struggle. He taught us that change comes from below, brought on by mass activism. He taught us that all wars are unjust and that soldiers die not for their country, but for political leaders who dupe them or conscript them into battle. And he taught us to move beyond patriotism and nationalism and to put away our flags. Now, I've known people who were 1/100th as famous as Howard Zinn and 1/100th as accomplished as Howard Zinn, who had egos 100 times bigger than his. He was a lovely and lovable man, and his teachings will be with us forever. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio one of the smartest people I know, Professor Gay Seidman of the Sociology Department at the University of Wisconsin. She wants everybody to know that we went to school together. And she has a book just coming out in paperback. It's been out in hardback a couple of years. It's called Beyond the Boycott. And she has activist roots herself. So we're going to be talking about how best to restrain multinational corporations and their exploitation abroad. That's what the book is about. Gay Seidman, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, and I think I'm speechless.
Oh, you can't be speechless. We got to talk. Gay, you and I were involved in the anti-apartheid movement together in college, and it's now 20 years after the release of Nelson Mandela from prison. Do you have any reflections on that?
Well, I think that we were right in the anti-apartheid movement to focus on the way multinational corporations exploited people around the world and profited from apartheid. I think that was, we were involved in the divestment movement, which was demanding that American multinationals withdraw from South Africa. And we argued that by staying in South Africa, they both exploited black workers and that it made us complicit in apartheid and paid taxes to the South African regime and provided services and goods to the military operation there. So I think that was a pretty serious tactic. And I think people forget that business culture before the anti-apartheid movement assumed that the business of business was business and that doing business as usual was what was the way that corporations could contribute to the world. And I think the anti-apartheid movement played a large – it was not the only – part of the movement that said corporations have some social responsibility, but it was a major part. And I think that's why I got involved in this, in writing this book, was listening to activists in the late 1990s and early 2000s talk about the Sullivan Principles as a model for how activists could be sure that corporations were behaving well around the world.
Yeah, I was shocked to hear that too, because I remembered going to one demonstration after another and writing one leaflet after another saying these Sullivan Principles that were named after Reverend Leon Sullivan were bankrupt and were just a fig leaf for apartheid and for corporations profiting off apartheid.
Let me just remind people what they were, because I think you'll see in them why they've become the model for corporate codes of conduct now. It was Leon Sullivan was a Baptist minister who found himself on the General Motors Board of Directors at a time when civil rights activists in the United States were saying that General Motors needed to do more for communities here, and anti-apartheid activists were saying that companies should divest from South Africa. He couldn't persuade the other directors to divest from South Africa, so instead he got General Motors and a bunch of other major corporations to sign on to a set of principles about how they should behave in South Africa. And the idea was that they would submit to monitoring. In the end, even Sullivan said it didn't work in South Africa, and he called on companies to withdraw. Many people at the time understood that, you know, General Motors staying in South Africa was participating and supporting apartheid no matter what it did in terms of integrating its canteens. And Sullivan came to believe it as well.
And a lot of the activists in South Africa at the time were in favor of divestiture and weren't in favor of these principles. And you talk about that in this book, Beyond the Boycott, as being an important factor, too. Why was that important?
Well, actually, when I did the interviews in the late 90s and early 2000s, most of them couldn't remember the Sullivan principles because they were so unimportant in South Africa. I think it became very obvious very quickly to activists that the problem was partly the nature of the principles, which didn't call on companies to actively protest apartheid because they said that companies had to work within the law, and the law in South Africa required racial division. Blacks weren't allowed to be paid above a certain level and so on. And they participated in the migrant labor system. So, you know, it was – but the other problem was that the outside monitoring, which is the part that they're cited – the Sullivan principles are cited today as the first example of companies submitting to non-governmental outside monitoring. It was incredibly easy for the companies to basically either give data that was false or to present the data in a way that hid what they were really doing. They present data on trivial things and ignore the larger things. And that's a pattern that you see over and over again with corporate codes of conduct. Even when they submit to outside monitoring, companies can easily mislead the monitors. They tend to figure out what the monitors want them to do and do that and ignore any other activities that would be real social responsibility. So, for example, in the case of South Africa, companies learned that if you gave money to township schools, they'd get an A no matter what they did within their factories. So that pattern over and over again, both in South Africa and in subsequent monitoring schemes, allows companies to do whatever they want and still get very high marks from outside monitors.
So your book, Beyond the Boycott, looks not only at South Africa. There are other two case studies in there. One is in India and the other is in Guatemala. I was ignorant, I have to confess, about the Indian campaign, which is called the Rug Mark campaign. This is probably more well-known in Europe than it is in the United States. Explain what the Rug Mark campaign
this was. This began in the early 90s when NGOs and some politicians in Europe and North America were beginning to say that there was so much child labor in the hand-woven carpet industry in India, and it was so exploitive that we should ban goods made by child labor, which would have hit the carpet industry really badly. So some German embassy staff people in New Delhi, working together with carpet exporters, created a monitoring program. Exporters of carpet industries could register their looms with a monitoring team. The monitoring team would go around and look at the work sheds and make sure no children were working on the looms. And then if they submitted to the monitoring scheme, Rugmark would give them a little yellow smiley face label that would go on their they could sew on their carpets. The problem over the last 15 years that's become incredibly clear, and I should just mention that Rugmark has now changed its name to Goodweave because they're trying to expand beyond the carpet industry to all kinds of other the entire apparel industry in India. But child labor activists, who were the ones who had originally exposed the problem of child labor in these carpet weaving sheds, found that Rugmark weavers became adept at misleading the monitors. There was only about 12 monitors. They went in teams of two. These sheds are sometimes hundreds of kilometers apart. By the time the Jeep is parked in the village and the monitors have gotten out of their car and they've walked to the shed, any children that are in the shed that aren't family relatives of the weaver are gone. And at this point, most of the child labor activists in India feel about the same way about Rugmark that anti-apartheid activists felt about Sullivan, that it's much more corporate camouflage than it is a real effort to get rid of children in the sheds. And they say that the labels have just created a new occupation for six-year-olds.
I'm speaking with Gay Seidman. She's the author of Beyond the Boycott. Did you go and look at some of those places in India where they were making the rugs?
Oh, yeah, I did. And I have to say, one of the things that shocked me was how much this focus on child labor. I'm not a child labor specialist, so I wasn't actually thinking about this when I started. I was looking for good examples of monitoring. I thought when I started that Rugmark was going to be a successful example. But I was kind of shocked that when we would go to these sheds, the 16-year-old who was working there in terrible conditions wasn't getting any international or corporate attention. It was just child labor because that's what international NGOs had raised. So I saw 16-year-olds working in terrible conditions, but that was not illegal.
And you also saw a woman get fired, you write about.
Yeah, she was the 16-year-old.
That was a brutal story.
Oh, yeah. It was
its outcome.
It was terrible. The exporter who took me to this work shed where this 16-year-old was working while I was interviewing her, was outside telling the master weaver that she wasn't tying the knots tight enough and she needed to be fired. And I have no doubt that when we left, that the effect of my visiting the shed was that she lost her job.
And you must have felt kind of devastated by that, didn't you?
Yeah. It was not what I was expecting, and I had no idea what to do about it.
And you were getting to the point that some of the NGOs, they focus on the most victimized person. They don't focus on, and maybe the house and garden variety exploitation that's going on with the 16-year-olds, but maybe the younger kids that make a better poster child for the campaign. And throughout this book, Beyond the Boycott, Gay Subman, you talk about how disempowering that is. Explain that.
So one of the things that I think we've lost sight of with globalization is in our efforts to think about transnational activism, we've lost sight of the way labor rights have often been intimately tied to the way we understand citizenship rights, that labor rights have both reflected people's voices on the ground and also redefined the nature of citizenship. It's been labor movements pushing for inclusion that have often led to more democratic processes around the world. Transnational activism, which has to appeal to a very broad range of global audiences, tends to focus on really extreme cases and voiceless victims. And they tend to call on transnational audiences to support people who can't speak for themselves. And in general, they're, I think, transnational campaigns. And I've been very active in a lot of transnational campaigns, so I'm as guilty of this as anyone. But there's a dynamic in transnationalism, I think, which tends to downplay the importance of giving people on the ground voice and instead talk about protecting vulnerable victims. And that's particularly true in consumer-based campaigns.
And what if they're voiceless, though? What if they don't have voice?
Well, and that's one of the things about consumer campaigns that I think is really valuable, that you can create greater consciousness about the conditions under which goods are made and perhaps create some greater movement towards other forms of regulation. I think the distinction I would make is between using campaigns to publicize abuses and think that those consumer-based campaigns are the way you can regulate workplaces around the world. Those are two different goals, and I think we should keep them very clear.
You talk about the ideological campaign to say labor rights are human rights, but your thesis seems to be that in going from labor rights in a national setting to an international setting, you're not only disempowering the people in that location, but you're also taking away the best remedy for their situation, which is working through local labor unions and pressuring the state, whatever the nation is, to get better laws on the books and better inspectors in the field.
You know, I think that the human rights campaigns are usually when I wrote this book, I argued that labor rights should be understood as something that are best enforced at the national level and best people should speak for themselves. The more I've talked about the book, human rights activists have come up to me and say, you know, human rights movements or human rights activists have moved to a very similar position in relation to human rights. The best way to protect human rights on the ground is to have a democratic state that protects its citizens. So maybe international campaigns can help create conditions in which those kinds of states can emerge. But we shouldn't think that over the long run, international pressures are going to protect, say, a Guatemalan villager from a lynching mob. Or those kinds of protections require a more national process.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me today Gay Seidman. She teaches sociology at the University of Wisconsin. She's the author of Beyond the Boycott. You just mentioned Guatemala, Gay. That's the site of your third case study here, a more successful one. Why don't you explain it?
Well, I should say that I started with the Sullivan Principles because I thought it was terrible. I thought that I was going to look at more recent examples that were successes and find good characteristics. Like, what should you look for in a corporate monitoring process? Guatemala, in some ways, is the group that I have the most respect for. There is a monitoring group there that has been very committed to it. It came out of Guatemala's civil war. It was people who were labor and human rights activists who had found that in the course of monitoring the peace process in Guatemala in the 90s, they found that American corporations and other companies working in Guatemala's export sector were really exploiting workers, and that they began to focus on labor rights. Arguing that Guatemala's culture of impunity was something that needed to be addressed not only in terms of sort of basic human rights and democratic rights, but also in terms of the workplace. Coverco is a very the people who work there have an enormous amount of integrity. They've worked really hard. They work very well with transnational activists, including with groups in Chicago in the Midwest that have worked with Guatemala for a long time. They argue that their work is a piecemeal strategy in the absence of state enforcement. They think that in the long run, workers' rights would be much better enforced if the Guatemalan state learned how to protect its citizens, because they say corporations that don't want to use them as a monitor find other groups that are much less that have much less integrity. So that as long as you leave it up to a company to choose its own monitor, groups like Coverco are unlikely to be doing any monitoring. And so they, even though I would say they're a successful example, they point to the problems with the entire approach, that stateless regulation allows companies to make decisions about who's going to guard the chicken coop.
And this is one of your themes, the limitation of stateless regulation by transnational activists. You also talk about the limits of the boycott against, you know, one logo or one subcontractor even. What are those limits?
I think it's pretty obvious. I was focusing particularly on the subcontractors. Focusing on a single logo is really a great way to mobilize global consumers and make them aware of conditions. It's way easier to focus on a single company than to think about conditions more broadly. But the truth is, most of us, if we're avoiding, say, Nike, are buying shoes from another company whose conditions are no better. And Nike's quite right to say, actually, they pay more attention to the conditions in their subcontractors now than some company that's never gotten international pressure. So these are tactical choices. For companies who are told there's a scandal in one subcontractor, it's incredibly easy to then cut that subcontractor and move somewhere else. And that's what really happens with a lot of these campaigns, that if you focus on one subcontractor outside Guatemala City where there's a scandal, the company ends production there, moves next door, often with the same employer, and you have to remobilize the transnational campaign.
Speaking with Gay Seidman, author of Beyond the Boycott, Matt Rothschild of The Progressive magazine, what does that mean as far as, you know, say the boycott of Coca-Cola, which was boycotted for its complicity with some murders in Guatemala and then Colombia. More noticeably? You have a thesis in this book, Beyond the Boycott, that there are real limits to the individual boycott as compared to the institutional pressure brought by churches or universities or other or unions, groups of people. I'm reminded about that because I was at a restaurant with a longtime peace activist from the 1960s at a Laotian place that my son is the waiter at, and I ordered a Diet Coke, or he brought me a Diet Coke because I always have a Diet Coke when I'm over there, and this 60s radical just was shocked and outraged that I was having a Diet Coke. What are the limits of the individual boycott?
Well, I think we should remember that for many people, the way they come to learn about a issue is through individual boycotts. So I would never say that those campaigns are useless. What they don't do is put that much pressure on the corporation. All of the cases that I found of companies submitting to external monitoring, if that's your goal, then individual boycotts don't do very well because it's very hard to mobilize that many consumers, and also very hard for those consumers to have any voice in corporate discussions, whereas institutional shareholders like universities or pension funds have been far more successful in going in and talking to corporate boards and persuading them to submit to outside monitoring. If that's your goal, then you can't do it through individual boycotts. It's important to remember, though, that a lot of the point of boycotts, if you look at, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s in the United States, consumer campaigns were a major part in laying the groundwork for fair labor laws because it made consumers and middle-class Americans aware of what conditions were like. So I would never say that you should have drunk that Diet Coke.
You heard me here. And then, of course, there's the grape boycott in the 1960s that was very successful.
Extremely. Grape boycott was incredibly important for bringing American farm workers into the American labor law system, that until the United Farm Workers had the grape boycotts, most Americans didn't realize that farm workers had been left out of the structure of industrial relations.
Okay, Seidman, how evaluate the Workers' Rights Consortium, this effort of activists on university campuses, including the one we're located at, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, to make sure that their university apparel, the sweatshirts and the gym shorts and T-shirts, are not made from sweatshop labor? How is that going?
Well, I think they're a wonderful group, and I have to say that I work with them, so I'm biased here. Their difference of opinion about what to do about stateless regulation within the Workers' Rights Consortium, many of us thought it was created in part to demonstrate that the corporate codes of conduct that were being monitored by other organizations like the Fair Labor Association weren't working, and that the Workers' Rights Consortium was meant to be a group that would respond to workers' protests around the world and to highlight abuses, not to monitor companies. Over the years, I think there's been a tendency for the language of stateless regulation to creep into discussions within the Workers' Rights Consortium, and in part because I think the Fair Labor Association has made that the terms of debate. I remain really skeptical that non-governmental groups anywhere will have the resources or the access to actually monitor workplaces. So I think the Workers' Rights Consortium does best when it responds to workers rather than trying to monitor.
And how does it work with local unions and activists in foreign countries?
Well, usually workers will contact the office and say, we have a problem in the factory. So then the Workers' Rights Consortium tries to publicize the problem, tries to work with, often with the subcontractors, to get them to fix the problem, to threaten global boycotts if necessary. This is a really difficult problem. Even the most radical members of the Workers' Rights Consortium, I think, acknowledge that globalization of production has put enormous pressures on subcontractors, that really when corporations set the price of a T-shirt and the subcontractor in Mexico or in China has to meet that price, every penny that they save on labor costs makes it more likely that they'll get the contract and keep their factory going. So a lot of the problems come from corporations trying to who force subcontractors to compete with the other subcontractors around the world and cut costs. And I think the Workers' Rights Consortium recognizes that. The problem is when they find a scandal, the contract is cut, the company's likely to move away from that factory completely, and there's nothing the Workers' Rights Consortium can do about that. And that problem persists.
The dream among some activists when globalization hit was that there would be labor solidarity across countries, and so that if the corporation that's exploiting people, even through a subcontractor in country X, would get hit in its home country by workers in that country. How is that effort going?
Well, that would have to be done through unions. I mean, these campaigns that I'm talking about are almost entirely consumer-based. And, you know, I think it's very uneven. It depends enormously on the union. It depends on the country that you're talking about. There's much more solidarity, say, within Europe than there is between, say, unions in Guatemala and unions in China, as you know. And it varies across industry as well.
So that's lagging, it seems like, in some areas.
It has proved far more difficult for unions to work together cross-border than I think anybody in the history of the labor movement has ever been really willing to acknowledge.
Yeah, because I remember I was working at Multinational Monitor, you know, 26, 7 years ago, and it was just starting there, and, you know, International Association of Machinist Workers were talking about.
It was not just starting there. It started in the late 19th century. It's been 100 years of unions saying they need to work together across borders, and I think there's structural reasons why it's difficult, although it's a completely different topic.
Do you want to say what some of those structural reasons are?
Nationalism. A big one is nationalism. Another is that workers find themselves pitted. They're competing for the same jobs. If the company says to workers in China, if we raise your wages, we're going to move our production to Lesotho and vice versa, everybody ends up feeling that their interests are not joined. It's trying to figure out how to develop a common set of goals and interests is not that easy across borders.
I wanted to ask you on a separate question. Nicholas Kristof, who writes for the New York Times, I like some of the stuff he writes, and then he writes on sweatshops saying sweatshops are good. What's your response to that?
You know, I think his argument is that, which I totally disagree with, is that any job is better than no job. You know, I think as long as we keep that argument going, we can't ever put a floor under labor standards anywhere. And so the effect of the argument is to say no one gets labor standards anywhere. And I think there's certain conditions that no one should be exposed to. Let's take toxic chemicals. Is it really true that no job, that it's better to work with toxic chemicals than to have no jobs? Well, in the short run, it is. But if your life is, if you're disabled because you're working with toxic chemicals and blind within a couple of years, it wasn't a good job. And I think his emphasis on the lack of alternatives, it just shows a lack of imagination on his part.
That there are other ways to get poor people employed and do development in the third world without just grotesque exploitation.
And that in the long run, grotesque exploitation doesn't help anybody, not the world in general and not the individuals who are working there.
It's an old argument that he uses, which is just an old comparative advantage argument, and I'm surprised it's still circulating to the extent that it is. Utah, one thing that I learned from this book, Beyond the Boycott, Gay Sideman, was a development in the activist community about how best to eliminate or reduce child labor around the world. And what you say is access to public education at an early age. How did that come around?
I should make it really clear I'm not a child labor specialist. I wrote about that in the book because I found that when I talked about the Rugmark case in India, so many people assumed that I knew about child labor that I had to learn something. I think the current consensus among child labor experts is that the Brazilian program, Bolsa Família, or Family Budget, in which poor families are provided with subsidies for food, for gas, and particularly if their child attends school for a certain number of days every month, the mother gets a small cash payment, that these conditional cash transfers so means-tested programs that create a floor under poor families are the best way to keep kids out of really exploitative work. It's not that kids don't work, but they don't work instead of going to school. They work in some jobs as well as going to school.
So here the flat-out ban may not be what's necessary, but getting them the education they need is what's necessary.
I think it depends. I think most parents want their kids to go to school around the world. I think it is no longer the case that many poor families think their kids would be better off keeping them out of school. That's just not true anymore. But there are lots of places in the world where schools aren't easily available, where the governments don't provide adequate school for poor children. They're too far to walk. The schools are terrible. In those situations, to get kids to school, parents may need some extra help.
We have about 30 seconds left. What would you say to an 18-year-old or 19-year-old who was like us at college and was outraged by some condition overseas and wanted to do something about it? What should that person do?
You know, I think I'm not going to answer that question because I never know what the next big campaign is going to be. I do think people should look close to home. I mean, people should be aware of conditions around the world, but it's a lot easier to make sure that your campaigns aren't counterproductive if you focus on stuff that you can see.
I think that's good advice. Start locally. There's always some injustice locally that we can attend to. You don't have to go far to find it, actually. Gay Sideman, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.